Welcome to Technovation, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, president of Meta Strategy, advisor to technology executives, Forbes columnist, book author, and your host. Each episode of Technovation features insights from top executives and thought leaders at the intersection of business, technology, and innovation. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please subscribe so you don't miss a thing. Thank you. My guest this week is Jeannie Ross. Jeannie is the principal research scientist of the MIT Sloan Center for Information Systems Research, an organization she used to direct and has been with for 27 years. She's also the author or co-author of several books, including IT Governance, Enterprise Architecture as Strategy, and most recently, Designed for Digital, How to Architect Your Business for Sustained Success. In this interview, Jeannie lays out the three characteristics companies must have to implement a successful digital transformation, which are experimenting repeatedly, co-creating with customers, and assembling cross-functional development teams. We also discuss the evolution of the chief information officer role, why companies shouldn't get so hung up on set roles of what a chief information officer or chief digital officer should do, but look to get away from structure, why having only 5% of revenue come from digital is actually an accomplishment, and a variety of other topics. Well, Jeannie Ross, welcome to Technovation. It's great to speak with you today.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I've been looking forward to this conversation. Jeannie, many people who are listening to this will know you as the former director of the MIT Sloan's School's Center for Information Systems Research, or CISR, as it's referred to, an organization that you've been with for 27 years now. You're the principal research scientist of the organization, also multiple-time author of IT Governance, of Enterprise Architecture as Strategy, two books that I've recommended many, many times, and now a new book, Designed for Digital, How to Architect Your Business for Sustained Success. And I thought we'd begin there. The topic of digital is pervasive, certainly on the lips of most executives, I would say, or let's say many executives in every industry. And a topic that is so broad, the topic of digital. And I wonder if we could begin with the definition. How do you think about the topic of digital? How much of it is truly new? And how much of it is, you know, perhaps a new brand name of some topics that are of an older vintage?
That's a great question to start with. I actually will take you back to the start of our research. We have 100 global sponsors of our research center, and we just try to stay in touch with what's going on in their lives. And about 5 years ago now, we talked to mostly CIOs of these organizations and said, what's going on in your world? And our summary of what they were going through is they were being bombarded by these digital technologies. It was social, mobile, analytics, cloud, Internet of Things, artificial intelligence, blockchain. And, you know, these technologies just kept coming at them. And with each one, there was some more hype about if you don't start using this, you're going to miss something. And our sense was that CIOs were being instructed to make good use of these technologies when their companies were still struggling to use information technology efficiently. You know, they're still trying to get their ERPs and their CRMs to produce real value. And now we have this whole other layer of digital technologies. So we wanted to study, and I think when people talk about digital, the thing to bear in mind is just what all these technologies are making possible that wasn't possible before. We have had information technology for a long, long time, but now we have technologies that are making data ubiquitous. They're making connectivity constant, and they're offering massive processing power. And the reason I think there's so much excitement is that on the one hand, they let us do everything we've always done better. We can become more operationally excellent, but they're also allowing us to do things we could never have imagined. That was the Uber moment where you can do more than give somebody a ride. You can give them information. And I think that is the digital phenomenon, the recognition that things are possible that weren't possible before.
Very interesting. And the whole notion of designed for digital, you know, as I think of that title, there are two different camps, very different. There are those organizations born in recent years who were designed digital from the get-go. They are born in the digital age. They are digital native
And as a result of that, they don't have, at least at the time of creation, the burdens of legacy. Then you've got the older vintage organizations, what I sometimes refer to as the digital immigrants, those who were born years ago, multiple decades ago before the digital age, the digital age as you've just defined it. And they have legacy versions of people practices and culture, of process, certainly of technology and an increasing debt there that needs to be retired. And in order for the latter camp to better compete with the former camp, there's a significant transformation that's necessary. And I know, of course, that a lot of your research, the companies that the nearly 200 companies, in fact, that you collaborated with in order to draw the insights for this book, are more from the latter camp than from the former. But I wonder if you could talk a bit about that challenge that these organizations have in competing with companies that can move so rapidly as a result of not having the kind of anchor weighing them back that is that legacy.
Yeah, you know, I think it's been overstated that we're going to compete with these startups. We've certainly seen it. It has happened. But my sense is that the big old companies, this is my affectionate terminology for successful companies, big old, they have some real advantages as well as a legacy that sometimes gets in their way. They actually know how to scale, for example. They know how to complete all their transactions very efficiently. A lot of the startups will end up struggling with the basics. So their moment of being able to move fast and not having to worry about legacy may in fact go away pretty quickly. So I think we probably overstate the disadvantage of being big and old in a world that you have to move very fast and you have to understand the opportunities. But that said, I do think that a big old company that wants to be successful in a digital economy does have to learn how to do things quickly, how to experiment with new opportunities, how to learn what's going to work and what's not going to work with customers. And I think this is something that the digital startups have tended to do naturally. Every startup we studied has this history of saying, well, when we started, this was our idea. Where we are now is somewhere pretty different. I often point to Airbnb for that. You know, the initial idea is we'll throw an air mattress on somebody's living room floor, and they will serve us breakfast in the morning, and then we're going to become friends, and they're going to show us our city, and it's going to be a real community building kind of environment. And, you know, that just wasn't of interest to that many people. So they saw what was possible and they adapted. And their strategy kind of seized the opportunity that was there. And the thing I think that will be hard, and is proving to be hard for established companies, is this idea that you can't just pick a strategy and insist it will succeed. You have to try a strategy and see if it will succeed. And if it doesn't, pivot. And I think that's a real challenge for big old companies. But if they start to learn to do that, they get very excited. And then they have all the advantages of brand name recognition and the ability to scale that gives them a real edge on the startup.
And do you find, Jeannie, that a lot of them are well positioned and even just culturally nimble enough to be able to cannibalize their existing offering, for example, or, you know, really do things differently, even if it means moving away from some things that have been the sources of their traditional success?
No, in fairness, the culture issue is huge. And it's mostly, I suggest to people that they not talk about culture, because once you say our culture doesn't allow it, you kind of give yourself this problem that you're not sure how to solve. So I recommend that even though it is a cultural issue, we talk about the habits that won't work in this environment. And then if we've identified them as habits, we can start attacking them and changing the habits. But to your point, there's a need to recognize that things are going to change. And I think there are a fair number of companies out there where senior leaders totally get this. So in a number of the automobile companies right now, automobile manufacturing, there is this recognition that we have two choices. One is to say, you know what? We sell more cars every year. We are not at risk. Let's just enjoy the present. And, you know, if I'm old enough, I can say I'll retire before anything bad happens. But the truth is that if I'm an automobile manufacturer, I also know that that constant growth in the sale of automobiles will not go on forever. And when it doesn't sustain my growth demands, what am I going to do? And I think that's why we see a number of the auto companies, this would be Toyota and Audi and a number of the American manufacturers saying, we have to get our heads around mobility services. We can be responsible for mobility, and that could be many, many different things. It could be scooters. It could be more car sharing. It could be public transportation. But we have a lot of capabilities that we'll just need to redirect to make sure we're providing mobility when the day comes that people won't be buying as many cars.
Yeah, that's interesting. I found it also quite interesting that of the many companies that I mentioned before, the many companies that were involved in your research, even those that were multiple years into their digital journeys, you found that 5% of the company's revenues were coming from new digital value propositions of one sort or another, which understandably was a disappointing number to these companies. What was holding them back? What did you find?
This is such a great finding and curious question, right? Why is it that we go to companies like a Philips, a Schneider Electric that have invested heavily? I think you would have to say their new digital offerings are successful. But when they look at the new revenues generated, they are about 5%. And I think that it makes the CEOs crazy. It's like, come on, guys, this is so brilliant. And we've really invested in it. And we want to get ahead of the competition. Let's grow this thing. But truth is, I'm not sure there's much they can do to go faster. We tend to think it's our culture holding us back. Well, guess what? It's your customer's culture too. You go to your customer with a new value proposition, you're asking your customer to change. So what companies like these are finding is you have to spend time with each customer to help them see the value and then get the value. And that is a very time-consuming process. Meanwhile, your salespeople are accustomed to selling one kind of value proposition, and you're saying, oh no, now sell this. So they have to learn how to do that. They have to absorb new relationships and new knowledge, and then they're dealing in many cases with resistant customers. So there's just a challenge here of getting the customers and then recognizing when and how to scale up. You have very different servicing needs. You don't want to get too far out in front of your skis and start creating all kinds of service capabilities that nobody cashes in on. So you're trying to incur expense at the time you're incurring revenue. So there's a real challenge scaling this up. And then you're trying to stay ahead of the needed changes that are requested by your customers because it's software. They're going to ask you to make changes all the time. And you have to roadmap what you can and can't do. You'll have to find partners to provide some things that you can't provide. So I actually think companies that are at 5%, and I appreciate that if you're the CEO, you don't want to just say good for us, but I would take a minute and say, good for us. It is good for you. And I would also say this is a warning for people who think they can spend a lot of money and rapidly grow a digital business. There is no evidence you can pull that off. So you want to be careful about how much money you spend at any given time, because you could incur some real risk here by spending big with the assumption that this is going to grow fast.
And what about the companies that have elected to acquire their way, the as you refer to, the buy versus build scenario, the Walmart purchasing Jet.com? Do you have any sort of general thoughts about that approach? Granted, of course, every acquisition is different, and the rationale for it will have all sorts of different factors behind them. But what are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think this is an opportunity that most companies have. And I do think it's one they should review carefully. I'm a little concerned about the tendency to acquire. You probably know the statistic that 75% of those acquisitions actually destroy value. They don't make value.
Indeed.
But these are often small acquisitions because they're small companies. So if you're not paying ridiculous amounts for them, there is an opportunity here because you could bring in perhaps a platform, perhaps a culture, perhaps some customers that would otherwise be hard for you to get. We observed the acquisition by Northwestern Mutual of LearnVest. I think this was a very savvy acquisition because Northwestern Mutual's history is with their financial advisors. And people love their financial advisors, and they're not going to get rid of them. But they look at the 20-somethings, and they say, those customers are lost to us. They don't want financial advisors. They want to do something online. If we want to bring them into the fold, we better do something that's more like a startup. Well, there was nothing in the Northwestern DNA to develop that. So they acquire LearnVest, and that brings them right away a product offering, a digital business that is already digitally savvy. It was interesting because we tell companies that they'll need a digital platform to run these businesses. And our thought was, you'd go buy a company and you'd get a digital platform. But it turns out a lot of the startups haven't really built platforms. They have built monolithic code. So what you're getting is something that's actually a lot of technical debt when you thought you were getting something without legacy. So you may have to actually rewrite their code. But if it's small, if it gives you customers that you like, if it gives you a culture that you haven't had, there may be real advantages to doing this.
You also noted that there are some characteristics of successful digital transformations that have bubbled up, three in particular. I'll provide the headlines, and I'd love for you to dive into some of the details behind each of them. They experiment repeatedly. They co-create with customers, and they assemble cross-functional development teams. Can you take a moment and describe why these three characteristics appeared again and again as you researched these successful companies?
Yeah, and I think these are all three challenges to big old companies. I think these kind of attack your habits because they'll tend to be different from what you've done. This experiment idea is to recognize that the digital economy is making new things possible. But for us to succeed, we need to find the intersection between what we can do and what our customers will pay for. And that is actually really hard to find. It sounds easy, but it's hard. I mean, if you're a pharma company right now, you are probably well aware that you can't just have a future of developing drugs. They take a long time. People want to take fewer drugs. We're trying to spend less on them. We want to stay well. We want to be healthy. And pharma companies are revamping their visions so they're as much about becoming disease experts and helping people prevent disease as they are in curing them. Well, this is a wonderful vision for a pharma company. But what's the value proposition here? How do we charge for keeping people healthy? What's our revenue stream, right? And I don't think anybody has an answer to that question. I think we start experimenting and we learn. We'll see what they will pay for. That's what the Googles and the Amazons and the Apples have done so effectively. It's not that they had this master plan. It's that they recognized opportunities when they presented themselves. So I think that's what we're trying to do with our experiments. It's very easy to throw a lot of money at experiments and get nothing. So you really do want to state hypotheses. You know, what do we think would actually work? And what can we do that's really tiny that would give us a sense as to whether we're right or wrong about that? And I think learning how to experiment quickly, funding these three-month scrums that give us some feedback on who likes what and what we can do, that's the gene we're trying to acquire here in the bigger, older company. But the idea of both experimenting and then being sure to learn from those experiments, that's part number one. The second thing is co-create with customers, and that's to solve the same problem. If we think we know what our customers want, we are in for a surprise. And I think the goal here, we see Philips doing this so brilliantly, where they will actually have workshops with potential customers. And they'll say, we are interested in solving the biggest healthcare problems. tell us yours. And this has led to a variety of services around the electrocardiograms and x-ray machines and electronic medical records that Philips already provides to customers. Now it's taking more of the data and providing more information to physicians, to intensive care units, to help them solve problems. But they did it by starting with a workshop where everybody kind of put the issues on the table and asked, what can we do creative to solve this? This is slow. It gets back to, why are we only at 5% of revenues? Well, it takes a while to develop this. And Philips is always placing a bet on, will this be reusable? If we do this for this customer, will somebody else want it? Because if the answer is no, they probably don't want to do it. But they're placing bets that they'll develop solutions and that future customers will want them, but they'll probably sit down and work with the second customer too, and the third customer, so that they can get a better sense of the general appeal of new offerings. So that second piece, that co-create, that is hard, it's very intense, it's slow, but when you're finished, you invariably have developed an offering that has real potential. And if you've developed it as a set of components that can be reused, you are then better positioned for your next customer. And then this last piece, cross-functional teams, this is just recognizing you do not want to just throw this all at your R&D unit or your IT unit and say, here, make us some code. This is a very iterative process. Of all the things we need to learn from the startup, we need to learn that the first offering is just something that gets people excited and invariably isn't all that great. And we want to learn how to develop these things. And so we'll have people from the commercial end and we'll have people from the IT piece and the customer service piece. So we're staying in touch with customers. We're testing ideas. We're imagining what's possible. We're road mapping things. So we're not taking on too much. All of that is part of this cross-functional team. And it means that the things you developed will go to market, as opposed to you'll develop them, you'll throw them over the wall and say, good luck. Let's see if we can't make a bunch of sales now.
It's interesting. A theme that runs through each of those is the need for greater collaboration, collaboration with customers, collaboration across the traditional silos of an organization. Especially bearing that in mind, what have you found in terms of the leadership model here? Who tends to be the shepherd of this? And I recognize they may carry various titles. But what are some of the common factors behind the individual who is the champion of this kind of change?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that we have seen probably more CIOs than any other position, but it is our typical entry point. So I'm not sure our sample is representative here. It makes sense that the CIO would often be a key leader here, because what it does in your company, when you really start getting your head around digital, you realize that part of all this digital technology, and we see this with IoT and mobility and AI, is it does make you better at what you do. And that's what the CIO's job has been for a long time, identifying ways to cut costs, to create more end-to-end service, to improve the access to data. And so we can now use these digital tools to do that even better. But we also see, and it's probably because they become more and more familiar with the technology, as they use it with both employees and customers, they start to identify new opportunities. We see the role of information technology moving from just an enabler, which has been its traditional role, to more of the inspirer of digital strategy. And I think there just have been some remarkable CIOs who have seen this. They have sold it to management teams, and then they've gotten enthusiasm for the experiments that will start to identify what's really possible for any given company. So invariably, I'm looking at companies like Toyota and Schneider Electric and Ferrovial, and I see the CIO taking a real leadership role, eventually becoming the chief digital officer, and then needing to hire a CIO to keep those ERPs and CRMs running and replace technical debt and add IoT and analytics where it makes sense on the operational side. But they also tend to have the innovation labs reporting to them where they're doing the experimenting and identifying what's possible going forward.
Very interesting. And just to take a couple of the examples that you have, that you offered rather, you've got Schneider Electric, where the CIO, Hervé Couré, was advanced to the CDO role. Now Elizabeth Hackinson, a longtime CIO Hall of Famer, multiple times over, a CIO of major organizations, reports into him. You've got Zach Hicks at Toyota, who has now this expansive purview as a EVP and Chief Digital Officer, as president of a digital unit of theirs, and Manjeet Singh, who's the CIO. And I'm curious, what are you seeing as a person who has studied the Chief Information Officer and IT leadership roles for quite some time? How do you see the balance between CIO and additional roles that are either advancement points for the CIO, then backfilled with somebody who carries that same title as they advance to Chief Digital Officer or other sets of responsibilities, versus a CIO like a Rob Carter at FedEx, who has as expansive a purview as a Hervé Couré, if not more, but still carries the just quote unquote just the CIO title.
Yeah. You know, Peter, we've always had trouble with the kind of what should I know about the CIO role, because statistically, every time we studied it, we never got any support for the idea that the CIO needs to be a member of the management team, which was always shocking to us. But we did survey after survey, and there was just no statistical support for that. And we were big supporters of CIOs and thinking, if you don't use IT strategically, you just can't be a great company in the 21st century. Well, what became clear is that savvy around technology is incredibly important, but there are many ways to get this. And so if you are a technology savvy leader, there are any number of roles you could play. You can certainly be the CIO, the CDO, the CEO. There are a lot of possibilities out there. And there's no single definition of the role of the CIO, or for that matter, the CDO. So we see companies kind of evolving into models that work for them, as opposed to saying, okay, here's what a CIO ought to be, here's what a CDO ought to be. We just assume that we have a need and we have somebody with talents, and we bring those two together. I think it's very hard to come up with a formula now that most companies can or should adopt. I think this has a lot to do with how savvy is the rest of the management team. What kind of needs do you have? What kind of opportunities do you see? How software savvy is your company? Has it always been part of R&D, or is this brand new for you? So I just think there's so many extenuating factors. You're just looking for visionaries who can take you further, and you don't want to get too hung up on the roles. In fact, generally, I suggest don't get stuck on the traditional ways of designing your company, which was to structure it. We're going to create this business unit, and we're going to put these people in, and we're going to give them these targets, and we're going to give them this much money, and this is what we expect of them. To the extent you can get away from a formulaic or a template approach to how we're going to accomplish something, and instead see something that needs to be done, assign some resources for the short term to attack it and see what they can come up with. This is our future. I think it's going to be uncomfortable for big companies where we like a little bit more order. We like to know what's in what box. But I think it's kind of hard to be adaptive and agile if we look for kind of the right answer out there. I don't think there is one.
It's interesting. Also, you've referenced the Innovation Lab, R&D capabilities, your most recent anecdote, which might translate perhaps to developing some capabilities at the edge, and then seeing which of those can become, ideas that can advance at scale. And I one of the things that comes up is this balance between kind of business as usual versus this innovation capability. Some people refer to this as the bimodal IT, but the cynics would translate that into sort of the haves versus the have-nots, or the sexy part of technology or digital versus the less so. And I wonder, to what extent do you feel organizations need to make a commitment to go to eventually get to a point where they're completely transformed towards digital operations versus having a foot in each world, if you will. And perhaps the answer is that it depends, but I'd be curious with your diagnosis.
Yeah, I think that the great news about this, after you've been working on this for years, it's likely still only 5% of your revenues that will be digital. I think that the reason that should actually be satisfying is it means that the things you've learned to do over years, the way you've succeeded, is going to be around for a while. And I think that is what we've learned about digital. We thought all retail stores would go away. We thought all paper newspapers would go away. It didn't, right? I mean, we're getting additional, not just substitutes. And so I think every business should assume that will be true, that we have to sustain the old and we have to get better and better. The mistake I think we make when we start thinking about the opportunities of digital technology is that we don't recognize there's two really different things going on. One is they make us better at who we are. So if I am running the core of my business that has been successful for a long time, perhaps manufacturing and selling automobiles, I need to sustain that. I need great people working on that, and they should take advantage of these new technologies. I should free them up to introduce those technologies into that environment, to use these technologies for operational excellence. These innovation labs are really about experiments around business models. How will we make money in the future? What are the new revenue streams that are possible because of digital technologies and that will replace any loss of revenue over time in other areas? So we have time in many, many industries. The threat is not immediate, but we have to believe that if we don't see the opportunities, somebody else will. And we're going to lose the moment, just like many taxi companies did. So we want to get out ahead of it. We want to experiment. But that's just one little lab. Right now, if you have no sense of what's really going to happen to your industry, that should be quite tiny. So most of your people are applying digital technologies to to sustain the main part of your business. And that can and should be really, really exciting. But the good news is it doesn't have to be as transformational as we imagine. We do not have to go out and redesign our entire company as agile teams. You know, I think we should experiment with a little agility, certainly with more evidence-based thinking in the company. But we don't have to turn the company upside down, and I actually would not recommend that. Do a lot of real experimenting around organization in your digital lab, and then kind of pick up some good ideas, some things people want to try on the main part of the business. And you can reduce your risk phenomenally and do a much more gradual cultural change here that will fit with your organization.
Jeannie, I also want to ask you about your methods. So you've now produced this great book. Again, congratulations on it. And as you now look for the next set of questions to answer, what will be your process? What has been your process? Is it one where you have a series of hypotheses that you go out and test, or is it more organic in as much as you have reason to, not only do you have a phenomenal network of technology executives and the like, that you just reach out to and engage in conversation to see what bubbles up? I'm curious how you find the ideas that become your research.
Yeah, I do much more inductive. My whole team does. My co-author Cynthia Beath and Martin Mocker and I have preferred inductive methodologies where what we want to understand really well is a problem. And then I would say our methodology is much more like a lawyer. We are going to go out and we're going to find all the evidence we can about how companies succeed in whatever problem area we've identified. So we are doing a lot of interviews early on just to get the temperature of what's going on out there. Then we're doing case studies of companies that are doing some really interesting things. Once we get some ideas about what worked for those case study examples, then we start creating surveys so we can get statistical data to support our findings or not. And so it tends to evolve. This is why the research takes about 5 years. from start to finish. Now, of course, we're building on what we've done. So right now we're trying to understand better and better the kind of technology environment you need to succeed in a digital world. And we already have 5 years of data that we've started to accumulate while we were investigating a slightly different question, but we'll be able to build on that and learn more about these technology environments.
That's great. Well, Jeannie Ross, it's been a pleasure speaking with you today. Again, congratulations on your new book, Design for Digital, How to Architect Your Business for Sustained Success. And congratulations on your many contributions to the field. It's been an honor to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Peter. It was really a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks for tuning in. Please join me this Thursday for our second bonus episode, in which Meta Strategy Vice President Chris Davis speaks with Diane Schwarz, the Chief Information Officer and Chief Digital Officer of Hunt Consolidated, and Andy Karaboutis, the Group Chief Information Officer and Chief Digital Officer of National Grid, about digital innovation.